Morning, Jeff. Mr. Gold?
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
Everyone is on the line. With your permission, I'll start the recording and get us on the record.
Let's go. Thanks.
Okay. The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before Consolidated Court Number 19-00104, Dong A. Steel Company et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Hello, this is Jared Goldfeder from Trade Pacific on behalf of Plaintiff Dong A. Steel Company and Fook J. Steel.
Morning.
Morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Robert Capuro from the Department of Justice Civil Division on behalf of the government.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And, Your Honor, this is Robert DeFrancesco from Wiley Ryan on behalf of Defendant Intervenor Nucor Tubular.
Morning.
Morning.
And with the Department of Commerce?
Daniel Wong with Department of Commerce.
Morning.
And we have another attorney with Wiley Ryan, correct?
Yes, this is Jake Frischnick from Wiley Ryan.
That's everyone, Your Honor.
Thank you. Morning, counsel. We are here on the tele-argument in the Dong A. Steel versus the United States. The case, which you know involves the Department of Commerce's calculation of normal value in determining the appropriate anti-dumping duty margins for the importation of heavy-walled, rectangular, welded carbon steel pipes and tubes from the Republic of Korea. It's a case which involves issues of the PMS determination under substantial evidence, whether the particular market subsidy adjustment was valid under the language of Section 504 of the relatively recent TPEA statute, whether Commerce's decision to use theoretical rather than actual weight in the anti-dumping margin calculations was supported by substantial evidence, whether the substantial evidence supported Commerce's decision to deny a TEP offset. Those are the basic issues. The parties, of course, have submitted various filings to the court. You have also submitted answers in response to the questions that the court sent you in advance of oral argument. And those answers are in writing, and for the arguments that will be proceeding, as you know, I suggest that each side view this as an opportunity to rebut the answers that were provided by opposing counsel in their submissions presented to the court. To the extent that a party wishes to make a brief opening statement, you're free to do that. As you know, it's 30 minutes aside, and I, for the plaintiff, I understand is there will be one attorney arguing, Mr. Goldfelder, and for the defendant and defendant intervener, there will be two attorneys, and that you will be splitting your time. Counsel, can you tell me how the time is being allocated between the defendant and the defendant intervener?
Yes, Your Honor. This is Robert Capuro from DOJ. We had planned, or I'm planning to keep my argument to as close to 20 minutes as possible, and we'll then conclude and defer the remainder of the time to defendant intervener.
Thank you, sir. Without any further delay, why don't we begin the proceedings, arguments, Mr. Goldfelder? Goldfeder, excuse me.
Goldfeder, thank you, Your Honor. Again, for the record, I'm Jared Goldfeder, Trade Pacific, counsel to plaintiffs Dongao Steel Company, or DOSCO, and Kukje Steel. I would actually like to make a brief opening statement before addressing the written responses submitted by defendant and defendant intervener to the court's oral argument questions. Plaintiffs respectfully maintain that remand is warranted for each of the issues raised in this action under the applicable standard of review. Deference is not owed to any determination such as the one here where Commerce failed to articulate a reasonable connection between its determination and the record evidence, where its methodology is not permitted by the statute, and where Commerce relied on data that it knew to be inaccurate. In the determination at issue, Commerce favored expediency over careful analysis of the robust record before it. It made decisions that introduced rather than eliminated inaccuracies and distortions into the anti-dumping calculations, and it engaged in often tortured analyses to justify the decision it seemingly had already reached, regardless of what the record evidence actually showed. In the case of the particular market situation, or PMS issue, Commerce's determination to make an adjustment for purposes of the sales below cost test was not in accordance with law, as the Court of International Trade has found now in several separate decisions. Furthermore, Commerce's overall PMS determination was not supported by substantial evidence when considering this administrative record on its own merits and in light of the prior decisions upon which Commerce expressly relied and which have now been rejected subsequently by the court. Defendant cannot overcome Commerce's own words as to why and how it reached the outcome it did to the PMS issue. Also critical is the fact that the PMS adjustment that Commerce applied was a highly inaccurate rate based largely on an adverse tax available rate applied to another respondent in a separate countervailing duty proceeding, and which in fact overstated the PMS adjustment by 4,300%. The Federal Circuit emphasized in Borland that deference is not owed to a determination that is based on data that the agency generating those data indicates are incorrect. The law does not require, nor would it make sense to require, reliance on data which might lead to an erroneous result, unquote. For the other three issues, Commerce's determinations bear no summons to the record before the agency, as I will discuss when addressing the other side's questions, and which I will turn to now. Beginning with the PMS issue, which presents both substantial evidence and in accordance with law questions, most of what we want to say in response to defendants and defendant intervenors' answers to the court were covered by our answers submitted a few days ago. Therefore, I will provide just a few specific rebuttal responses. Unlike the next deal line of cases, which focused on situations involving price to constructed value comparisons only, the present action involves a case in which DOSCO reported home market sales, and thus, as part of its calculations, Commerce performed a sales below cost test, and as part of that test, it increased DOSCO's cost by the amount of the PMS adjustment.
Excuse me, counsel, I'm having a little difficulty hearing you.
Okay. Is this better?
This is better, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So, as part of its calculations, Commerce performed a sales below cost test in which it increased DOSCO's cost by the amount of the PMS adjustment. Thus, the court in Nexfield did not need to address whether Commerce's PMS determination was in accordance with 19 U.S.C. 1677 subsection B. The situation in the present action is more akin to those in the Saha, Thai, Husteel, and Borosun cases, in which the three reviewing judges separately reached the conclusion that Commerce is statutorily permitted to modify a respondent's reported costs because of PMS only when calculating normal value using constructed value under Section 1677B, Subsection E, and not when normal value is calculated using selling prices or for purposes of the cost test under Section 1677B, Subsection B. Neither defendant nor defendant intervener has presented any argument that should lead to a different conclusion in this case. Words matter, and that is especially true when it comes to matters of statutory interpretation. As the Supreme Court stated in Connecticut National Bank versus German, quoted in the Husteel decision, a cardinal canon of statutory interpretation is that, quote, courts must presume
that a legislature says in a statute what it means in a statute what it says there, unquote. And the Supreme Court also said in the Duncan v. Walker case, quote, where Congress includes particular language in one section of a statute but omits it in another section of the same act, it is generally presumed that Congress acts intentionally and purposefully in the disparate inclusion or exclusion, unquote. And that encapsulates the issue here. Defendant intervener, for example, devotes its entire 20-page limit to arguing that this court in Husteel failed to provide Chevron deference to Commerce's interpretation of the statute. But step one of the Chevron test asks if the statute's meaning is clear, and if it is, that meaning controls. Only if there is an ambiguity does a reviewing court reach step two to determine if the agency's interpretation of the statute was reasonable. Obviously, defendant and defendant intervener wish that Congress had drafted the statute differently when enacting the TPEA, and they are left to providing extensive legal dissertations as to why they believe the statute is ambiguous and how Congress meant something else. However, the statute's meaning is clear on its face when examining the statute's text and structure, as well as the legislative history, and thus Chevron Step 2 is never reached. That is, while Congress included particular language to amend the constructed value provisions of the statute in Section 1677B, subsection E, it omitted any such amendments from the sales below cost provisions in subsection B and the special rules for calculating costs at subsection F. To borrow terminology from the Husteel ruling, defendant and defendant intervener are attempting to bootstrap the TPEA amendments made to other portions of the statute to subsection B. Defendant and defendant intervener have presented nothing in the statute or the legislative history to show that Congress intended to apply the PMS rules to the sales below cost test, despite the fact that Congress excluded such language from those provisions. Commerce may not act beyond its statutory authority as it did when making a PMS adjustment in the context of the sales below cost test. Words matter as well when it comes to the substantial evidence question. Defendant tries to escape this court's holdings in the Nexteel and Hyundai Steel cases by arguing that the records of those cases were different. But Commerce did not find a PMS based on the differences in the records, but rather based on the similarities. Commerce's issues and decision memo emphasize that, quote, we determine that the circumstances present during this review, that is the PMS allegation itself and the record evidence concerning the allegation, remain largely unchanged from those which led to the finding of a PMS in Korea in the other reviews. Commerce cited those prior reviews over and over as the basis for its decision. We do not dispute that the present record included additional documents, but there is nothing in Commerce's determination to suggest that these additional documents influence the outcome in any material way. In fact, while defendant repeats that Commerce is presumed to have considered all record evidence, it cannot point to any instance in which Commerce actually relied on any of this new evidence as a basis for its determination. Rather, Commerce found that because the record evidence was largely unchanged, its PMS findings should not change. And by relying on prior determinations in other cases to reach the same conclusion without undertaking any other type of analysis of the market conditions or Dalso's purchasing behavior for the hot-rolled coil, Commerce's determination was beset by the same type of evidentiary void that rendered its determinations unsupported by substantial evidence in other cases, in the other cases on which Commerce relied. While this court considers the earlier rulings that invalidated Commerce's PMS findings to be non-precedential, plaintiffs respectfully submit that the court should find them to be highly persuasive nonetheless, whereas here, Commerce so clearly relied on them to support its determination. Defendant elsewhere argues that the court's decision in Nexteel 1 turned on Commerce's reversal of position. We disagree. While that was one aspect of Commerce's determination that the court considered, the court specifically stated that, quote, it does not stand to reason that individually the facts would not support a particular market situation, but when viewed as a whole, the same facts could support the opposite conclusion. The court concludes that Commerce's determination of the existence of one particular market situation in Korea is unsupported by substantial evidence, unquote. We said that the court's basis was clear. And finally, with regard to the temporal aspect of the PMS analysis, defendant cannot provide a meaningful response to the court's question as to at what point Commerce's continued determination that a PMS exists because becomes part of the country's ordinary course of trade. In other words...
Counsel, can I ask you a question on that? How can a particular market situation be considered part of the ordinary course of trade when Section 504A of the TPEA explicitly defines PMS to be, quote, outside the ordinary course of trade, end quote?
And I think, Your Honor, that's our point. When finding a particular market situation outside the ordinary course of trade, the definition of ordinary course of trade implies a temporal aspect that this condition should exist for a reasonable time prior to exportation. So implicit in the ordinary course of trade provision is that a condition is not going to be everlasting. But that's what Commerce's determination here implies, because the conditions that it considered in the period of review here had already been in existence for at least 2 years. There's nothing. So the reading of the ordinary course of trade provision suggests that these should not be conditions that have been going on forever, because if it's been going on for a long time, then that is essentially the normal. And, you know, even if you accept that there were distortions in the market caused by these conditions, at some point, if they stay and continue, that becomes the new normal. And then implicit in that is it is now part of the ordinary course of trade.
Your position is that PMS cannot be considered part of the ordinary course of trade.
Our position is that at some point, even if Commerce finds it existed at some point, if that condition continues in over a long period of time, at some point it is not outside the ordinary course of trade. It is part of the new normal market conditions. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of interpreting the reasonable time portion of 1677 subsection 15. The definition of ordinary course of trade, which implied a type of temporal restriction. But Commerce's determination and the fact that they keep reaching the same decision over and over in every case, and now, you know, for this review period, essentially saying that these conditions have been going on for at least 3 years, at what point is it no longer extraordinary? At what point does it just become these are the conditions? These are the market dynamics. This is now the ordinary course of trade. That is an aspect of this issue that Commerce has not addressed. Unless Your Honor has any other questions on the PMS issue, I'd like to proceed to the weight issue.
Please proceed.
On the actual versus theoretical weight issue, while defendant cites a long line of cases in which Commerce has used theoretical weight, it agrees that Commerce may use either actual or theoretical weight in its calculations, as we've stated. Both actual and theoretical weight derive from formulas, but whereas actual weight reflects the actual thickness of the input steel coil and the finished pipe product, theoretical weight is calculated based on the nominal thickness stated on the invoices and which are subject to tolerances. The actual thicknesses are always going to be less than the nominal or theoretical thickness, and that's shown on the record, which means that the actual and theoretical weights are always going to differ. But exactly how much they differ depend on those varying tolerances. Second, while defendant states that Commerce has an express preference for theoretical weight, and while that may reflect Commerce's more recent trend in the last few years, historically Commerce has emphasized the importance of ensuring that prices, expenses, and costs are reported on a consistent basis, whether actual or theoretical, across all markets and costs, so that there is no mixing and matching of weight bases. Third, a defendant repeats the incorrect claim that actual weight was not readily available in Dostal's records. Defendant cites a statement from the Section A response, but overlooks that Dostal corrected that statement subsequently in the Sections B and C questionnaire responses when it confirmed that, in fact, actual weight is recorded internally in the company's records. Yet Commerce never inquired any further on this issue, and in the final determination, faulted DOSCO, even though DOSCO explained that the relevant information existed in its internal records. And defendant concedes that DOSCO's questionnaire response statements are considered record evidence. That includes DOSCO's explanations that actual weight can be found and traced to the company's records. Next, defendant cites the fact that DOSCO submitted theoretical weight-based data, implying that somehow DOSCO supported the methodology Commerce used, and that theoretical weight data was necessary to compare sales and costs on a consistent weight basis. But defendant again fails to mention that DOSCO submitted theoretical weight data only in a supplemental questionnaire and only because Commerce specifically instructed DOSCO to do so. In the initial questionnaire responses, DOSCO submitted only actual weight-based data consistently for both sales databases and the cost database because that was the appropriate basis on which to perform the calculations. The implication that DOSCO endorsed theoretical weight-based calculations because it submitted the data on that basis overlooks the procedural history of the case. And at no point did Commerce find that it was unable to compare sales and costs on a consistent weight basis using actual weight data, as defendant also suggests. Rather, Commerce just simply wanted to use the theoretical weight data. Fifth, defendant focuses largely on the undisputed fact that the sales invoices mentioned the theoretical weight, but this fact alone does not mean it was more accurate to perform the calculations on a theoretical weight basis. On the contrary, while DOSCO's invoices provided theoretical weights and stated terms in that weight basis, we don't deny that, DOSCO explained in its questionnaire responses that the negotiated selling prices with its customers were done on an actual weight basis. And that's important because its customers understood that DOSCO was going to use a smaller thickness of input coils, but within the tolerance levels to satisfy the customer's order, and the theoretical weight stated on the invoice was presented for the customer's purpose. Thus, while the normal commercial practice was to identify the nominal thickness and the calculated theoretical weights on the invoices, the commercial reality is that all prices were negotiated and the costs were incurred according to the actual weights, the actual input coils and thicknesses. These are all part of DOSCO's questionnaire responses, which defendant, again, acknowledges as part of the record evidence. Sixth, the differences between the actual and theoretical weights were far larger for U.S. sales than for home market sales because of the varying tolerances between the two markets, which introduced the types of distortions we described in our briefs and in our recently submitted responses to the court's questions. But Commerce introduced distortions and inaccuracies by choosing to use theoretical weight data in the calculations rather than the more accurate actual weight data. And finally, defendant reasons that because the CONUM, the control number, was based on nominal product dimensions and theoretical weight was based on nominal dimensions, there should be a correspondence between the CONUM and the theoretical weight. But Commerce never articulated why there must be a correspondence between the weight basis used to determine one component of the CONUM that is used to identify the optimal product matches and the weight. They never articulated why there must be a correspondence between the CONUM, which, again, is used to determine the best matches, and the weight bases that are used separately to report the per-unit prices, expenses, and costs. Commerce routinely relies on CONUMs where the product characteristics are unrelated to specific cost factors. So, again, here, Commerce failed to articulate a reasonable rationale for its decision based on the record of the underlying review. Instead, it just basically relied on its prior decision with no independent analysis of this record that was before it. Unless Your Honor has any questions on this issue, I'll move on to the next one.
Please move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the CEP offset issue, actually, before I address defendant's specific responses, I want to put the CEP offset in a bit more practical context. The CEP offset is a reduction to normal value that is equal to the amount of the indirect selling expenses that a respondent incurs for its home market sales, capped at the amount of the indirect selling expenses deducted in the constructed export price, U.S. price calculation. The reason for the CEP offset is that the selling activities required to make sales to home market customers are more significant than the selling activities required to make sales to a U.S. affiliate. The additional selling activities for the home market level of trade are reflected in higher indirect selling expenses and, in turn, higher selling prices, So the CEP offset is intended to ensure the fair comparison by adjusting the normal value to reflect downward, to reflect the higher level of selling activities and indirect selling expenses required for the home market level of trade. Thus, all the discussion deriving from the statute and Commerce's regulations as to whether the home market level of trade was at a more advanced stage of distribution or marketing than the level of trade of the sale that DOSCO makes the U.S. affiliate relates to whether normal value should be reduced in order to ensure accuracy and fairness in the calculations. Plaintiffs maintain that substantial record evidence demonstrated that the selling activities that DOSCO performed at the home market level of trade were not only different, but were far more significant than those performed to make sales at the CEP level of trade. Defendant claims that DOSCO failed to provide evidence that it was entitled to a CEP offset. We disagree. Commerce's questionnaire instructed that to show entitlement for a CEP offset, a respondent was only required to fill out a standard selling function chart and to provide narrative explanations for the selling activities performed at each level of trade. Commerce's questionnaire did not request supporting documentation beyond the selling functions chart, and yet DOSCO went above and beyond Commerce's requirements by submitting nearly 50 pages of fully translated documents related to the sales and marketing activities that DOSCO performed to support home market sales, but which it did not need to perform for sales to DOSCO America at the CEP level of trade. On top of this, DOSCO separately submitted supporting documentation showing various freight and delivery activities and sales-related administrative activities that DOSCO performed for each level of trade. Both defendants' suggestion that DOSCO failed in some manner to provide supporting is incorrect. Certainly, Commerce never requested any additional information or clarifications regarding DOSCO's CEP offset claim in any supplemental questionnaire or otherwise indicated prior to its determination that any deficiency existed in the record regarding this issue. Defendant's response focuses principally on the inventory functions, and that is an important aspect for understanding why Commerce's CEP offset determination was unsupported. The preamble to Section 412, subsection C2 of Commerce's regulations clarifies that, quote, it is sufficient that, at the more remote level, the seller takes on a role comparable to that of a reseller if the merchandise had changed hands twice, unquote. In one of the four core selling function categories identified by Commerce, the inventory maintenance, there was no question that DOSCO maintained on-site inventory from which it made sales in the home market, but all sales for the U.S. were produced to order. In this critical aspect, it was obvious that DOSCO had taken on the role comparable to that of a reseller further down the chain of distribution for home market sales when making sales to the U.S. affiliate at the CEP level of trade. Defendant's response is that this was not significant because salespersons just reviewed stock ledgers and DOSCO did not incur warehousing expenses on its home market sales. But this completely misses the point. First of all, DOSCO's inventory maintenance was on-site, and a company only reports warehousing expenses in the home market sales database when it uses an off-site distribution warehouse. Second, the CEP offset analysis focuses on indirect selling expenses, not on direct expenses such as warehousing, off-site warehousing. And third, inventory maintenance does not involve simply reviewing stock ledgers when making sales, but rather maintaining stock on-site for extended periods of time. Leaving aside Commerce's conclusory but unsupported statements regarding the required resources, the fact that DOSCO undertook inventory maintenance for the home market level of trade demonstrates that if DOSCO took on the role comparable to that of a downstream reseller if the merchandise had changed hands twice, because it is storing the merchandise so that its customers didn't have to. And that, again, importantly, a function that it did not perform at the CEP level of trade. This alone showed that the home market level of trade was at a different and more advanced stage of distribution than the CEP level of trade. When considering additionally the substantial sales and marketing activities that DOSCO undertook to make sales at the home market level of trade, including especially the large team of salespersons versus the, as compared to the paucity of activities required to service DOSCO America at the CEP level of trade, the court should find that Commerce's determination was unsupported by substantial record evidence. And finally, on the cost adjustment for painted products, defendants' responses underscore the fundamental defect in Commerce's determination. Defendant concedes that neither the statute nor Commerce practice establish a threshold as to what constitutes a significant cost variation so as to warrant such an adjustment. So in defendant's view, Commerce knows the significant cost variation when it sees it, but that does not obviate Commerce from its legal obligation to articulate a reasonable basis for its determination. Commerce based its determination on what it referred to as the large fluctuations in cost between condoms that created distortive cost differences in the calculations. But Commerce never explains what it means by large, by fluctuation, or by distortive. Does any difference in cost between condoms that are identical but for the pain characteristic rise to the level of a distortion? If so, how does defendant reconcile this decision with its separate determination that there were no distortions caused by differences in using theoretical weight versus actual weight data in its calculations? Defendant cites the Commerce's cost calculation memo, but those analyses merely show that cost differences existed between condoms that were identical but for the pain characteristic, a fact that was not in dispute. Commerce never provided any analysis of the record data to show that the differences were sufficiently large to justify the smoothing methodology employed in the final calculations. Defendant's response is merely a post hoc rationalization that focuses on two outliers involving very minuscule production quantities. And finally, defendant misunderstands the point regarding the DIFMR adjustments. By smoothing in the manner that it did, Commerce eliminated cost differences before performing the product matching, so when Commerce compared a painted condom to a non-painted condom, the calculations could not increase or decrease normal value to account for the variable cost differences between similar merchandise because Commerce had already masked them through its smoothing. And this is another example where Commerce introduced distortions under the guise of seeking to eliminate them. Plaintiffs, I want to express again their appreciation for the court's careful consideration of these issues and the arguments presented by the parties. And unless the court has any further questions at this time, Your Honor, plaintiffs rest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Goldfeder. I do not have any further questions. We'll hear from the defendant and defendant intervener. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And again, this is Robert Kapira from the Department of Justice Civil Division on behalf of the government. I'd like to make a brief opening statement before turning to the court's questions.
Please,
the Commerce Department, thank you. The Commerce Department's final determination in this matter should be sustained as it is both supported by substantial evidence in the administrative record and consistent with the statutory scheme. Three of the six issues presented to the court involve the existence of and Commerce's adjustment for a particular market situation concerning the input costs for HWR from the Republic of Korea. Commerce's interpretation of the relevant provisions of the Act are both consistent with the plain language of the statute and the legislative history of the 2015 TPEA. Further, substantial evidence in the record supports the underlying factual determination that a PMS exists in the Republic of Korea. In addition to the PMS issue, substantial evidence also supports Commerce's determinations concerning the use of theoretical weight as opposed to actual weight, the denial of a CEP offset, and the adjustment for the cost of hot-rolled coil for condoms with almost identical physical characteristics. And with that, I'd now like to turn to our rebuttal to Dosco's responses.
Before you get into that, could I just ask you a question regarding the status of some of the key cases that have been cited? So that would be Nexteel 1, Nexteel 2, Hyundai, Taha Thai, and Husteel. In other words, where do they stand? Are they being appealed? What is the status, if you know?
I don't have the specifics on each of the cases, but what I can say, Your Honor, generally is that none of those cases has yet been appealed, but generally regarding the PMS issue, of the cases that Your Honor just mentioned, more than one of them is either still within the remand period or still being considered. So the short answer, Your Honor, is that the appeal period for those has not yet run. So the Federal Circuit has not yet weighed in on this issue, though that opportunity is still open.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a recent Nexteel decision after remand last month?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct.
And, well, anyway, I won't keep you any longer on that. I will give the parties, as I always do, an opportunity to make a brief post-argument submission of not more than 1,250 words. And if in the course of that submission, if you decide to make a submission in any event, if you could just lay out what the status of those cases are, that would be appreciated.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. And turning to our response to plaintiff's response on the court's questions, particularly with regard to question one and its subparts, the key issue here is that plaintiff's response concedes the main point here, which is that the Nexteel and Hyundai cases, while they could be considered persuasive authority, they are not controlling, and that the issue presently before the court is the application of the appropriate legal standard to the particular set of facts in this review. Thus, the government's position is that the court should review the record evidence in this case independent of the legal determinations concerning the PMS issue in the Nexteel Hyundai cases and the other cases that were just mentioned, Husteel, Borasan, and Sahatai. I won't get too far into the details of the differences between the cases that were mentioned in the court's questions. As I, in listening to plaintiff's response, I think there's actually a certain level of agreement in that, particularly with regard to Nexteel 1, that case is distinguishable from the instant matter, particularly with regard to this issue of the change in position, Commerce's change in position from the preliminary decision to the final decision, and that the court highlighted that change and the lack of any change in the underlying evidence as key to its finding in that case. And similarly, with the other two cases mentioned in the court's questions, Nexteel 2 and Hyundai, both of those cases cited back to Nexteel 1 as persuasive authority. So given the difference between Nexteel 1 and the instant matter, our position is that those cases are distinguishable and certainly not controlling authority over the present issue. Turning to the plaintiff's response to the second question. Again, the response here points back to the case law, which we just discussed as persuasive but not controlling. The court's question referred to the broader statutory purpose that Commerce refrain from using distorted values in its calculation of margin by any means. Plaintiff's interpretation of the statute would defeat this purpose. Well, we acknowledge that the existence of a PMS-related distortion of the cost of input allows Commerce to utilize a constructed value as a basis for normal value. Plaintiffs argue that Commerce would be required to use those same distorted inputs as the basis for its calculation of the cost of production. And again, this would defeat the entire statutory purpose because Commerce would be relying upon data that it has already determined is distorted and prevents a fair comparison. Furthermore, the difference that plaintiffs have highlighted between the statutory language in 1677B subpart B really amounts to a distinction without a difference. Subpart B3 does refer to the ordinary course of business as opposed to the ordinary course of trade, but the change in the statute that allowed the introduction or allowed the analysis of the PMS in the ordinary course of trade can reasonably be read through
into this portion of the statute because, and again, we look back to the legislative history and the underlying purpose. Essentially, what plaintiffs are arguing is that because the language of subpart B3 refers to the ordinary course of business as opposed to trade, that that would then force commerce to rely upon these distorted inputs when calculating the cost of production. If there's no questions on that, Your Honor, I'd like to move to question three, which refers, and we maintain our position here that plaintiffs failed to exhaust their administrative remedies by failing to raise this issue before commerce. But the issue here is plaintiff's response focuses on a length of time as a limiting factor when the statute contains no such temporal restriction. The operative provision for finding a PMS is Section 1677.15 subpart C, and that subsection contains no temporal limitation. Instead, the relevant question is whether the PMS actually exists during the period of review, not how long it has existed. So, and I believe, you know, the court discussed this issue quite thoroughly with plaintiffs, which is that their position is that even if there's a market distortion, if that market distortion goes on for long enough, it should just be considered ordinary and no longer a distortion. That's not what the statute provides for. The statute provides for identifying that distortion and whether or not that distortion exists within the period of review. In this case, it did, and Commerce explained that finding as supported by substantial evidence. If there's no further questions on that, Your Honor, I'd actually like to, in the interest of time, I'd like to move to our rebuttal to their response to the court's question number 8 concerning the issue of the raw materials costs.
Sure.
So, again, the first part of the court's question referred to our argument concerning waiver, and plaintiffs cite to a couple of pages in their rebuttal before Commerce. However, those pages referred to an assertion made by the petitioner, and nowhere in that section did DASCO raise either argument that it is presented to the court. First, that Commerce should have performed some sort of quantitative analysis to find that there were large fluctuations in cost. And second, that Commerce's determination undermined the statutorily required DIFMA adjustment. Neither of those arguments were raised in that section. So again, we reiterate that they've failed to exhaust their administrative remedies with regard to that, those arguments. But moving beyond that and looking at the sub-questions A and B, DASCO's response before the court is actually a deviation from the position that it took at Commerce. In its response, it appears to challenge the very existence of a large fluctuation. However, if you actually look at their rebuttal before Commerce, the pages 17 to 19 that it cites to in its rebuttal brief, DASCO acknowledged that there were large differences in the raw material costs that were unrelated to the physical characteristics, but they attempted to provide an explanation for those differences. So those explanations in and of themselves represent an acknowledgement that substantial record evidence exists to support Commerce's finding that differences existed between the raw material costs for different condoms and that those differences could not be explained by their physical characteristics. Finally, on this point, plaintiff acknowledges that Commerce has the authority
to make this type of adjustment. And as discussed above, or previously, Commerce's determination was supported by record evidence. So, therefore, Commerce both had the authority to make this determination, and it was supported. Therefore, it is the government's position that it should be sustained.
I have a question, counsel, arising from your one of your responses to the questions for oral argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
On page 5 at the bottom. And the question was, did Commerce actually rely on such evidence in reaching its particular market situation determination here? What record evidence supports your position? And the response begins, yes, Commerce relied both on evidence that it considered in other proceedings and new additional evidence on the record of this administrative review. Commerce considered all the evidence on the record to consider the totality of the circumstances, even if Commerce did not individually address each piece of evidence. I'm wondering if you could explain further the difference, if there is a difference, between consideration of the evidence and reliance on the evidence. So one might say that Commerce is entitled to a presumption that it's considered all of the available record evidence, but is consideration of the evidence synonymous with reliance on the evidence? Isn't reliance not merely consideration required?
Well, if I'm understanding Your Honor's question correctly, I would agree, yes, that there's a difference between consideration and reliance.
5 minutes.
Certainly. Thank you. Yes, there is a difference between those two things. But beyond that, I'm not sure I'm understanding the court's question.
Right, so are you saying that you relied on the evidence? I mean, it was not simply that you considered the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. In part, Commerce did rely on evidence that was presented in other proceedings, as well as the new and additional evidence. So it relied on both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And with the additional time remaining, I'd like to return to question 4 that the court presented to plaintiffs regarding the theoretical weight. And the primary issue here is that plaintiff acknowledges that there is no requirement that Commerce use one method over the other. Therefore, the question before the court isn't whether, ultimately one method or the other would ultimately be more accurate, but whether or not Commerce's decision to use the theoretical weight was reasonable and supported by substantial evidence. And in this case, it was. Mm-hmm. Because Dasco does not physically weigh its merchandise after production or before shipment, Commerce made this determination of whether to use theoretical weight versus actual weight. And it should be noted that both of these methods are calculated weight bases. So Commerce laid out its 3 reasons for utilizing theoretical weight. First and foremost was that Dasco provided sales and cost data based upon theoretical weight for both its home market and U.S. sales. Second was that Dasco's invoices to its customers were based upon theoretical weight. And third, that the condoms used to match the home and U.S. market sales are created based on the nominal product dimensions, which is the same method as used to calculate the theoretical weight. And this provides a correspondence between the product condom and the theoretical weight. Further, plaintiff's argument that there's this variation within the tolerance levels, runs counter to you know, the evidence presented, because essentially what they're saying is that there's a distortion within their, effectively they're saying there's a distortion within their method of accounting. Because as we just pointed out, Commerce relied on the invoices and the method that Dasco used to track its sales and cost data when building its theoretical weight calculation. So, you know, to say that there's a variation in there, yes, that's true, but it's also the very method that that Dasco employs. So this evidence supports Commerce's determination to use theoretical weight versus the actual weight presented by Dasco. And if the court doesn't have any questions on that, I'd like to briefly address the CEP offset issue before I defer to interveners.
Thank you. Please do address the CEP offset issue.
Thank you, Your Honor. And again, just briefly, the plaintiff's response is an invitation to the court to reweigh the record evidence. And in fact, they begin their written response to the court by stating that they disagree with Commerce's, quote, characterization of the evidence, unquote. So again, Commerce's position is that Dasco's home market and U.S. sales and marketing activities are not substantially different, and that this is supported by substantial record evidence. I would point back to our brief, pages 30 to 33, for the detailed support to this, but without going too far down into the weeds in it, our basic position is that the issues raised by Dasco are essentially a disagreement with how Commerce evaluated the substantial evidence, not whether or not substantial evidence exists to support Commerce's position. It does, and therefore the position should be sustained. And with that, Your Honor, if you don't have any questions directly for me, I will defer to the intervener.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kipura. We'll hear from Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
DeFrancesco now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Could I get a quick time check just to check to see how much time I do have?
10 minutes.
Great. Thank you. Okay. For the record, thank you, Your Honor. My name is Robert DeFrancesco on behalf of Defendant Intervenor, Nucor Tubular. We'd like to start simply by saying that we support the government's briefs and answers to questions on the various issues that the government's addressed. We are here today to focus on one particular issue, and obviously that is the statutory interpretation as it relates to particular market situation and the authority that Congress had given to Commerce to make adjustments in those calculations. Specifically, we'll simply go right into the plaintiff's responses to the answers as it relates to this issue. Plaintiff's answers focus almost exclusively or largely on the Hoosteel court decision. But frankly, our answers relate to the Hoosteel court decision as well as Nexteel and SEA. They all rely on similar statutory interpretations. And as we mentioned in our answers, we believe that court's analysis was incomplete and did not apply the proper test by giving the proper weight to the legislative history when examining Chevron Step 1, and certainly not the statutory structure as it relates to how Commerce normally applies cost adjustments, regardless of whether we're talking about a PMS scenario or not. Specifically, and by doing so, I should say that the interpretation doesn't give the proper amount of deference to Commerce's interpretation of its statute, and as the Federal Circuit has mentioned in Apex Foods, the anti-dumping statute reveals a tremendous deference to the expertise of the Secretary of Commerce in administering anti-dumping law, anti-dumping and countervailing duty determinations involve complex economic and accounting decisions of a technical nature for which the agencies possess far greater expertise than the courts, and certainly how to apply TMS and how to make those adjustments that we believe is one of those instances. Specifically, we heard earlier from the plaintiff, and this relates to one of the flaws we believe that exists in the Hoosfield courts and the other courts' analysis of the statute, in that the courts are saying because the COP portion of the statute doesn't expressly reference this adjustment, you can't then make the adjustment. But that ignores all a series of other types of adjustments to cost that also aren't expressly referenced in the COP portion of the statute that Commerce makes all the time before running the below cost test, and specifically, actually, some of the cost adjustments the plaintiff is complaining about in this case, or types of cost adjustments, where those cost adjustments are made to either smooth cost or adjust cost in some way, and those adjustments are made, and then the below cost test is run. And frankly, adjusting cost to account for a particular market situation distortion is really no different. And the COP portion of the statute that talks about calculating cost is in fact identical. The way the costs are calculated, whether we're talking about calculating costs under the COP portion of the statute or in the constructed value portion of the statute, is identical. So it's not as if there are somehow different cost calculations depending on whether you're calculating normal value using home market sales or constructed value. The cost calculation is the same. And so we believe the previous court's analysis seems to confuse that issue or maybe not understand that the cost calculations are the same, and that the PMS scenario here that we're talking about prevents a fair comparison under the statute, regardless of whether we're talking about a cost adjustment, either when we're talking about constructed value or a COP, a home market sales scenario. The other thing we would point out, and we pointed out in our answers to the questions, is that the previous court's decisions, again, don't seem to understand that you could be in a scenario where Commerce is calculating normal value using home market sales where it still applies constructed value to certain sales. So, for example, you may have a scenario where there are certain sales in the home market that don't match to U.S. home to U.S. sales. The Department of Commerce will look at what we call the DIFMR adjustment, and if it's outside of that DIFMR adjustment, it then will go to constructed value to calculate a normal value for those particular sales that are matching to the U.S. sales. And so it inherently incorporates constructed value in a home market sales scenario, and the amendment to the constructed value statute therefore also pulls in the idea of PMS in that type of scenario. And that mixed calculation is not addressed anywhere in the statute, but it's a practice that Commerce has applied consistently.
5 minutes.
Thank you. Across many different cases. And lastly, I'd like to point out that in looking at the statute and the statutory construction, the particular market situation provision itself that exists in three places in the statute is not limited or doesn't limit itself in any of those three places in the statute to a certain situation. In other words, the Hoosfield Court and the other courts seem to be confusing a particular market situation that affects sales in the one context and cost in another, and that's not true. The provision of the statute where it's talking about particular market situations in all three contexts are not limited. They are not limited in that way. They're not talking about a particular market situation exclusively to only one type of situation. In fact, the definition, it refers to situations and is not limited to sales or cost in and of itself. And so it is possible that you would have a particular market situation that prevents a fair comparison
that affects costs or sales and could be adjusted in either context in the outside the ordinary course of trade language incorporates that concept across the statute.
And so really, it's your position that the court in Hustil and in Hyundai Steel, Sahatai, erred in their statutory interpretation regarding PMS under the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. We believe the court erred by they should have found that the statute is at best ambiguous as to whether it should be applied. Frankly, we believe the way the statute is constructed is clear to us that if Commerce finds a particular market situation that is distortive, they have to make an adjustment, whether that distortion exists on the sales side or the cost side, and the statute does not limit them to throwing sales out. They can make any sort of adjustment that allows for a fair comparison. The statute doesn't limit them to throwing certain sales out, and the proper analysis would have been under a Chevron Step 2, not Step 1, and we believe that's where the court erred. But to go back to Your Honor's question, even reading the existing particular market situation language that existed under home market sales, and I would point out, under 1677B1B, at the very beginning of that, the statute talks about the price for which the foreign-like product for consumption in the exporting country in the usual commercial quantities and in the ordinary course of trade to the extent practicable at the same level. That's at the very beginning of that statutory section that's talking about normal value, and it's incorporating outside the ordinary course of trade, which includes particular market situation definition in 1677.15. It permeates the rest of the statute, and then if you continue on in that section of the statute, where it talks about in 1677B3, the administering authority does not determine that a particular market situation prevents a proper comparison. And then when talking about third country sales, the particular market situation in the exporting country does not permit a proper comparison with the export price. Again, nowhere in that either of those statements does it talk about sales. It's simply talking about preventing a proper comparison. And the outside the ordinary course of trade language is much broader and not limited to a sales or cost distinction. In fact, where it says a particular market situation in the ordinary does not prevent a proper comparison, it's providing Commerce with the discretion to adjust either of those scenarios to actually make a proper comparison, which is what they've done here. And the amendment to TPEA, by incorporating particular market situation in the constructed value portion, is simply confirming that, yes, you can make this adjustment for sales and costs or make other adjustments, and that the previous court did not properly analyze the statutory construction. And our brief and in the answers to questions that Your Honor posed, we believe, provides a better framework for thinking about how the court should be interpreting the particular market situation. So I know I'm probably out of time, so I will wrap up and happy to answer any questions that Your Honor has.
Thank you, counsel. I'm sure we'll be getting an answer from the government. As I mentioned, I will give all parties an opportunity to make a submission of not more than 1,250 words post the argument. But I was wondering, what is your understanding of the, we'll call them the PMS cases, in terms of whether they are all on remand, or are they on appeal? What do you have any knowledge about that? Nexteel, Hyundai, Sahatai, Hustil.
So, Your Honor, this is Robert DeFrancesco. As the government mentioned, all of those cases are in various states of
remand. None are yet, as far as I'm aware, on appeal at the Federal Circuit, but the time period for any of those cases that I'm aware of hasn't yet fully run, such that I would anticipate that one or all will ultimately be appealed to the Federal Circuit, but that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to say at this point, Mr. DeFrancesco?
Sorry. No, Your Honor. I think that concludes our presentation, and like I said, happy to answer any other questions Your Honor has.
I don't have any further questions, but I will give each side 2 minutes, beginning with Mr. Goldfeder. If you would like to respond to anything you've heard or and make any points additionally, now's your chance. So 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think we'll obviously have a lot of things to say in writing, up to 1,250 words after the oral argument. Obviously, we've heard a lot about the in accordance with law aspect of the PMS issue, and I think, you know, what we heard comes back to the point we're raising, that, you know, there's a lot of saying, hey, if you look at this provision, and you kind of draw arrows and go each way, you get to the conclusion that this is what Congress intended. But, you know, as much as defendant intervener are quick to say that Commerce should get all the deference and presumptions in the world, they're, you know, very dismissive of Congress. And, you know, when you look at the plain language of the statute, where Congress intentionally and purposefully added the provision to the constructive value provisions but not the sales below cost provisions, it's obvious and clear what the intent was. So, you know, we come back to, you know, the decisions that have been reached on this issue of whether Commerce has the statutory authority to make a PMS adjustment in the process, we believe are correct, that the plain language of the statute does not authorize it. There is no ambiguity. I guess on the other issues, there is, ultimately, you know, Commerce has the obligation to calculate anti-dumping margins accurately and free of distortions. And, you know, we're not asking the court to reweigh the evidence in any way. We're just saying that, you know, in looking at the reasonableness and the supportability of this determination, you know, the court should consider the different ways in which the Commerce Department's actions and its flawed reasoning led to final calculations for DOSCO and then in turn CUPTE that were unreasonable, that made the calculations less accurate and introduced distortions and inaccuracies when Commerce is supposed to be preventing them. So on that, I will rest. And again, thank you, Your Honor, for your careful consideration of these issues, and we look forward to supplementing in writing after this argument.
Thank you. So I will give the defendant and defendant intervener 2 minutes. Do you want to split your time?
Sure, Your Honor. Just briefly, again, this is Robert Capiro from DOJ. We will update the court on the individual status of the cases that were mentioned. And just briefly, I think the positions on this have been fairly well laid out. But again, just to reiterate, you know, we're looking at a statutory interpretation issue that ultimately, if and when it reaches the Federal Circuit, you know, will be reviewed de novo. And the position that we return to is that the the purpose of the 2015 amendment was to, you know, give Commerce this authority to address these distortions. And the, you know, while we understand the arguments, you know, coming from, you know, the various plaintiffs in these cases, ultimately their position would frustrate that purpose and would force Commerce to conduct its calculations based on information that is distorted. So I think that, you know, that's an argument that has not, you know, clearly been addressed yet, that weighs heavily on this entire discussion. And with that, I'll defer to the intervener for any final points.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just quickly, the amendment to the statute in TPEA, Congress added, it did not subtract, it did not take away authority from Commerce, and the plaintiff's argument here and, frankly, the previous court's conclusions essentially leave a scenario where, and the government's already referred to this, they would be forced with a scenario where they find a particular market situation such that it prevents a fair comparison, but then not be able to make an adjustment to account for it. And that's simply inconsistent with the legislative history of the TPEA. It's inconsistent with the statutory construction. And they're simply reading language into a portion of the statute and applying standards to Commerce that simply don't exist, and they don't exist even outside of the PMS context, where Commerce continually makes adjustments to cost that are not expressly referenced in the COP portion of the statute. And the PMS adjustment is no different. So with that, Your Honor, we'll conclude, and as the government mentioned, we'll be happy to address Your Honor's questions again in that short post-hearing statement.
Thank you. That concludes our argument this morning. And now the afternoon. I'd like to thank counsel. I know these are challenging times for advocacy. This pandemic has certainly complicated the process in some ways. We all wish we were back in the courtroom at the United States Court of International Trade. But I thank you all for your continuing cooperation. And I hope that you stay safe and are well. And until we meet again, the court is adjourned. Thank you.
Court stands adjourned.